This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Danny Wisentowski. Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Danny Wisentowski, in for Elaine Shaw. It was only about a decade ago that Missouri was known as the meth capital of America. Police raided thousands of self-made laboratories, seizing chemicals and drugs in vast quantities, especially in the rural areas of the state. At one point, Missouri accounted for about 15% of all meth seized nationwide. The image of meth addiction also became familiar to those watching TV, and at pharmacies across the country, cough medicine became a controlled substance. Meth changed society as we knew it. And while Missouri is no longer known as a meth capital, that's not because meth is no longer a problem here. But just how did meth become such a prominent product of our state? How did its various recipes spread so broadly? And why did it hit so hard in our state's rural communities? For that matter, how did meth get to Missouri in the first place? Well, a new podcast is taking up these questions and more. It's called Home Cooked, a 50-year history of meth in America. It is hosted and produced by Olivia Weeks. She's a reporter for the Daily Yonder, and she joins us now. Olivia Weeks, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Olivia, this podcast debuted earlier this month, but before we dive into Missouri's special role here in this story, tell us a bit about what inspired you to tackle this project. Why meth?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I've been interested and maybe at various points, I would say I've been obsessed with methamphetamine for like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. And I think the origin story for me really is that, so all throughout my childhood, I grew up in a small town in southern Illinois called West Frankfort. And all throughout my childhood, I heard a lot about meth lab explosions on the news, and there was this overpass out by my grandpa's house where people would say, every time we drove by it, somebody would say, oh, you know, I think they make meth out in the woods out there. So it was like kind of a specter in my childhood just because of where I grew up, I think. And then when I went to college, I don't remember thinking that much about meth in high school in like 2014 to 2018. And then when I went to college in 2018, I got really homesick, so I got obsessed with the Talk West Frankfort Facebook page. And on the Talk West Frankfort Facebook page, there were always all these posts about how there were just meth heads roaming the streets of West Frankfort. They were really kind of derogatory and, stigmatizing. There was a lot of stigmatizing language on there, that kind of thing. But people were really kind of obsessed with this idea that meth was ruining our town, and that any kind of social ill in the town had something to do with methamphetamine. And there were rumors constantly that every single person I knew was on it. And I don't know, it was just really sort of a source of fear for people in my town. And then, so I sort of started thinking about that. And around the same time, there were a lot of reports that meth was quote unquote back. It's not your neighbors cooking it anymore, but meth is a big problem again. And so I was like, you know, what's that about? Is it true? Is this some kind of moral panic? That kind of thing.
Right. And so your podcast, it is presented, as I said, the title, The 50-Year History of Meth. Now, meth has been around, as you kind of acknowledge in the podcast, for a very long time. And depending on where you want to trace back, you could go back to World War II. You could talk about the Nazis. You could even, you know, go further back in the use of stimulants. But I'm curious, what was it about that 50-year range? Why start the journey there?
Yeah, it's a bit of an imprecise marker, but I really think that meth gets interesting in 1971, because that's when it's regulated as a Schedule II substance. Prior to that, meth was very widely and easily accessible to the American public. It was available by prescription. Up until the late 60s, it was available over the counter as a nasal decongestant. And so I think it's interesting to start thinking about meth in 1971, when legal production of methamphetamine is greatly reduced by the regulation of the federal government, and then the black market starts to form.
Now, I'd like to invite you, our listeners, into the conversation about this history of meth and its role in Missouri. How has meth impacted you and your community? What's changed since meth's peak in Missouri around 10 years ago? And what challenges persist around you? Give us a call at 314-382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at STL On Air or email us at talk@stlpr.org. Now, Olivia, in the podcast's first episode, you tackle a very fascinating question. And the question is, how did meth come to Missouri in the first place? And you open into this subject of, is there a Johnny Appleseed of meth? Is there more than one Johnny Appleseed of meth, someone who pioneered this in some way? You found some records of a Missouri man named Bob Paillet, who seemed to maybe be this figure. Can you tell us a bit about him? And did this really come down to just one person?
Yeah. I want to, before I start talking about Bob Paillet, I want to just say that the peak of meth in Missouri really is right now. The peak of...
That's a good point, yeah.
Domestic production of methamphetamine was maybe 10 years ago, or maybe actually I think in Missouri it was around 2004. But the peak of methamphetamine, there's more in Missouri right now than ever before. And so I think we'll talk about that at some point in this conversation. But just, it's important to separate out domestic production of methamphetamine from the amount of methamphetamine available
on the street. And to your point, you know, the meth capital of the U.S., that was really something about the specific seizures and busts of these homemade labs. So I appreciate that clarification, and we definitely are going to talk more about that. But tell us about Bob Paillet and what you found there about this Johnny Appleseed theory.
Yeah, so in the 1970s, after meth is regulated as a Schedule II substance, it's really these outlaw biker gangs that come onto the scene. It sounds like an unlikely story, but I mean, the research really supports the fact that it was these outlaw biker gangs who come onto the scene and develop meth's first illegal production regime. And these bikers sort of run meth distribution on the East and West coasts. On the West Coast, it's the Hells Angels. It's an interesting and weird story, but basically, in every region, there's an idea that one of these bikers came from California and taught all of his buddies the recipe to make meth. And in Missouri, there's a really specific story about this one guy named Bob Paillet who had been a truck driver or biker, it's kind of unclear. And he had gone to California and then come back. And then there's also a story that he was at some point in the Missouri State University library looking at chemistry textbooks, and he came across the recipe for the Birch reduction method, which is a way of making methamphetamine using ephedrine. And the story also goes that there was a swastika on this chemistry textbook, and that's where the name Nazi dope came from. I think this is all sort of subject, I subject it to a lot of my own suspicion. I think this is a pretty unlikely story of how that recipe developed. But basically, it gets reprinted in the media just over and over again that it's this one guy who comes from California and discovers this recipe and tells all his friends, and then you can trace the lineage of Missouri meth exponentially backwards from whoever the cook is that's on trial today back to the friend he learned it from and the friend he learned it from, and it will all eventually lead back to this guy, Bob Paillet. Now, I spoke with an academic named Aaron Gilbreth. He's a geographer who studied meth, and he said that these stories are pretty fantastical, but it is true that because, especially before the internet, you had to be taught how to cook meth by someone else, by an experienced chemist or an experienced cook. So it is true that you can sort of trace the lineage of meth cooks back, at least prior to the internet.
Now, it's interesting, you know, it seems such a complicated challenge to try to trace a particular drug back to a particular person. I will say I did find, you know, the Springfield News Leader in 2017 did a great deal of investigation into Bob Paillet. They talked to the former head of the Springfield DEA at the time. He said, I really believe that his, Bob Paillet's method here in Springfield was the bounce to get meth spread throughout the rest of Missouri and the United States. Could it be a little bit of one and another? Is there some truth, you think, that he made an impact here in Missouri?
I'm sure he did. And I'm sure that he taught lots of people who taught lots of people how to make meth. But I also think that there were probably 12 Bob Paez in the state of Missouri at that time or more. You know, it's kind of impossible to measure.
Yes, and I should mention Bob Paez did pass away at the age of 72 in 2016, so he is not around to tell us who he taught or where he learned it from. Now, I want to get to this subject of Missouri as the meth capital of the U.S., and I mentioned that this was based on the number of meth seizures that were happening. There was a lot of law enforcement emphasis. What did you learn about how Missouri attained this label?
Yeah, the label is really partially deserved. So in 1997, Missouri law enforcement discovered like 300 meth labs. And by, I think it was 2001, they discovered like 1,300. And so Missouri always had larger meth bust numbers than its regional neighbors. And it also, the problem grew faster in Missouri than elsewhere. And it's a little bit unclear why. Again, it could come down to cultural connections between sort of California bikers and truckers in Missouri. That's really, really impossible to measure. But the one thing we know for sure is that Missouri had a bigger meth lab problem than the states around it, even though the states around it had big meth lab problems in the early 2000s and late 90s.
Olivia, I want to explore another distinctive piece here, and it's the impact on rural communities and the prevalence of meth there. You spoke with Will Garriott. He's an anthropologist and researcher who has studied the spread of methamphetamine. He said meth transformed how we think about rural America and how rural America thinks about itself.
What made it even more interesting is that the methamphetamine problem was being presented in a way that was very different from the drug problems of the past. So if you think about the 20th century, you think about something like crack. It is racialized and spatialized as an urban drug used primarily by people of color. That is a kind of stereotypical understanding that a lot of people bring to their thinking around drug issues in the United States. Here we are then in the first decade of the 21st century, and we have a very different racialization and spatialization of this new drug of concern, methamphetamine. So this was seen as a drug that was having a particular impact in rural communities and predominantly white communities.
That was Will Garriott speaking to Olivia Weeks on the new podcast, Home Cooked, A 50-Year History of Meth in America. Olivia, you interviewed Will Garriott and others about this notion of meth as a particularly rural crisis. Why did it hit these rural communities so directly? And is that notion that this is a rural problem, is that true?
It really depends on the time period in question. And it also really depends on the region in question. So in the Western United States, meth always functioned more like a traditional drug, like cocaine. There were these large super labs that produced meth, you know, within the U.S. or south of the U.S.-Mexico border, and distributed methamphetamine along more traditional drug trafficking routes. In the Midwest, on the other hand, the mom-and-pop meth labs that we've been talking about were really, really common. And some distinctive features of the mom-and-pop meth labs that we've been talking about are that, first of all, you use farm chemicals sometimes. Anhydrous ammonia is a farm fertilizer. And that's a major ingredient in some of the recipes that people were using to make methamphetamine in the 90s and early 2000s. And so that ingredient is much more likely to be available in agricultural and rural areas. So that's one association between meth and the countryside. And then it also smells really bad to make meth. So that ammonia smells like cat pee. I've heard it described that way.
All right. Thank Olivia, we'll continue that in just a bit. But we do have to take a quick break. But we'll be back shortly to continue this conversation about the history of meth.
The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
In Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights, at Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on The Gateway, on the STLPR app and wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm Danny Wisentowski, in for Elaine Shaw. We're talking today about the history of methamphetamine and Missouri's prominent place in that story. Now, if you were watching TV in the late 90s, you may have caught a particularly memorable PSA. Aired during a commercial break, it featured a woman obsessively cleaning her home. The subject, the grim consequences of an addiction to meth. But the PSA itself, well, it was undeniably catchy.
Look at me, busy as a bee. Where'd I get all this energy? Oh, meth, meth. I don't sleep and I don't eat, but I've got the cleanest house on the street. Oh, meth, meth. Get these hairs all out of my face. Get these bugs all out of my place. One more hit, no time to waste. Oh, meth, meth.
That was the infamous 1997 PSA from the Office of National Drug Control Policy and the Partnership for a Drug-Free America. That's the same group that gave us This Is Your Brain on Drugs. Now, as absurd as that upbeat jingle seems now, it's symbolic of the approach to drug prevention at the time, a belief that you could shock and scare people, especially young people, into living a drug-free life. That ad isn't airing anymore, but the need for public health and education around meth and drug abuse, that hasn't gone away. Nicole Dawsey has been working in just those fields for more than a decade. She is the executive director of the nonprofit agency Prevent Ed, and she joins us now. Nicole, welcome back to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And oy, what a jingle, huh?
What a jingle, I know. And we're also still here with Olivia Weeks. She is a reporter with the Daily Yonder. And before the break, we were talking with her about her new podcast, Home Cooked, A 50-Year History of Meth in America. So Olivia and Nicole, I played this PSA because I think a lot of folks my age saw it, saw campaigns like it, the Faces of Meth campaign, and it really stuck with my generation. I've never quite understood, did this thing actually work? Nicole, what was your takeaway from this?
Well, let me say it again. Oy. I think the jingle and the Faces of Meth, you know, really points to the fact that for tale as old as time, we've really struggled as a public health field to hit home the message about the consequences without bordering on scare tactics, right? I think we saw peak scare tactics in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. And the Faces of Meth, the jingle, the face, This Is Your Brain, This Is Your Brain on Drugs, all of those things just led to incredibly stigmatizing thoughts, language around people with substance use disorders, really created this notion, particularly with meth, that it was something for, you know, rural hillbillies, basically. We saw some of that even when the opioid and heroin epidemic started hitting, right? And I think that our challenge is to balance what we know to be true, which is younger kids, particularly middle schools, they do respond to things that are like gross out factors, right? So you can talk about bad breath and you can talk about, you know, impact on dental hygiene and things like that. But you do have to strike a balance between presenting facts and consequences that might prevent them from starting to use versus really just trying to scare folks and exaggerate the consequences. And we know now that that is not okay. Yeah. And that doesn't work.
Olivia, I wanted to ask you about this PSA as well. You looked really into this era of the late 90s and the early 2000s where things like this continued. What did that evoke about the time? What did you find about why people thought this was the way we're going to stop folks from using meth?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I don't understand the reasons why so well, but I do think that I got, in the course of reporting this podcast, I got a really good sense of sort of the effect that campaigns like these had on people who would ultimately try meth or become habitual users of meth. For instance, this man I spoke with named Chris Jones, who's now in recovery, he's a peer recovery specialist in Northwest Arkansas. He was telling me about seeing that commercial for the first time where it says, "This is your brain, and it shows the perfectly intact egg, and then this is your brain on meth, and then the yolk is cracked. He told me about seeing that commercial for the first time, and then later on he tried meth, and then he was reflecting on it, and he said, you know, once my yolk was cracked, once I had tried meth, I really believed that I was done for, that there was no going back. And so I think the effects of those scare tactics were really to sort of convince a generation of users that there was no going back from trying a drug or from addiction of any kind.
Right, right. Nicole, I wanted to ask you, you began your career in prevention around, you told me, about 16 years ago. This was around, you know, 2011, 2012, you know, at this point of incredible intensity and, you know, where Missouri was considered this capital of meth production or where these seizures were happening. Set the scene for us a bit. What was the landscape of meth use like, and what were the challenges you were trying to confront at the time?
So I started my career in this substance use field really in 2006, 2007, 2008, and working at a local health department, Jefferson County Health Department, actually, which, you know, Jefferson and Franklin sort of toggled back and forth for the title, you know, meth capital of the world. And there was a lot of boots on the ground efforts. And when I say boots on the ground efforts, what I mean by that is going into grocery stores and working with merchants to make sure that they were regulating the sale of some of these chemicals that were used in the home labs, right? Helping them understand what questions to ask, not to automatically assume because somebody was buying lighter fluid that they were making meth, but if they were buying lighter fluid plus a few of the other, you know, precursors, that they needed to start asking some questions. Doing needs assessments and surveys and in local counties to figure out what were they seeing, what did they need, working with law enforcement, child protection services, because there was a tremendous environmental impact and health impact on young children who were living in these labs. You know, I think that there were local coalitions that were coming out. And as a matter of fact, I started my work in something called MAC, which was the Methamphetamine Action Coalition in Jefferson County. We worked alongside law enforcement. And I think that's where we can sort of kind of get into this, which comes first, chicken or the egg, where Jefferson and Franklin counties really known as meth capital of the world because more people there were using meth than there were more home labs. Or, and this is my theory, is that there were more resources being dedicated to discovering and busting those labs. So literally, agents would go out in the middle of the night sniffing, because as was mentioned before, meth here had a very distinct odor like cat pee. And so they would go around and they would sniff. Well, if you're sniffing for something, you're going to find it, right? Mm-hmm. And it didn't mean that other places didn't have it, but resources were coming in at a federal, local, and state level to really look at how to break these labs down and get people help.
Olivia, what do you make of that point? You know, the notion that, you know, it wasn't just that it was the supply and the manufacturer of Missouri that gave it this prominence, but it was the sheriffs and leaders who were putting that emphasis, and wherever they looked, they found more meth.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that point. And I had cops in the course of reporting Home Cooked, I had cops tell me the same thing. You know, they would say, yeah, I think we had a huge meth problem. I think there were a ton of people cooking meth. I think Missouri was a particularly rural state, so it was an easy place to cook meth. But also, I think that the amount of resources that we dedicated to stomping out the meth problem sort of inflated the numbers. Or not inflated, because there were labs, but yeah, they rose the numbers. And so I think that's really astute, and I would agree with it.
Nicole, you mentioned your work in those early years or during the meth crisis in Jefferson County. Tell us a bit of can you share some of those experiences? You know, what were some of the first things that you saw, and some specifics of what did you learn about the best ways to serve people, you know, going through that at the time?
I love the podcast because it really is taking me back to when I was first doing this work. And, you know, some of the things that really were hitting home with me that we were really focusing on was getting into classrooms, trying to teach them about what they were seeing, what they might be experiencing, not just in their homes, but also if they had relatives that were dealing with methamphetamine usage, helping them, not in the scare tactic way, but helping them sort of identify why meth is probably not a good idea for them, talking about stimulants and talking about the fact that if they're prescribed stimulant drugs for attention deficit or things like that, that that's okay. So we were doing a lot of that education. We were doing a lot of education with real estate agents because at the time there was very few restrictions around how much you had to disclose if a house was a meth lab. And we now know that, you know, there were really some pretty significant health impacts. Working with first responders and making sure that they were wearing hazmat suits when they were responding to these meth lab crises. And one in particular initiative that really sticks out in my brain is that we were working with folks from Children's Division to create car seat covers and stuffed animal collections so that when they would remove children from a meth lab, that they could put that child into a car seat, not exposing the next child that would be in the car seat, and that they also could give them a new stuffed animal because all of those animal, all their belongings were contaminated, right? We also did initiatives called Give Kids a Smile, where we were working with local dentists to combat the effects of meth mouth, which I know that's probably not the best term now. I don't really know how to say it nicely, but those are just some of the initiatives we were doing on the ground.
You know, to your point almost of the way we talk about the effects, and you know, these are people, and like they suffer, and they didn't, you know, they don't always deserve to be have their face put up there. And a lot of folks, they do come through this, they do recover. Is there a lesson that you do draw from maybe some of these PSAs and the way we did talk about these folks? You know, have we changed? Is there a better way to look at the people who are actually going through this?
1,000%. We as a field, we as a society have really changed and have put people first language at the center. For example, we don't talk about addicts. We talk about people with a substance use disorder. That language change is huge. And you mentioned the fact that, you know, if somebody is using meth, that if they can get treatment, it is worth noting that there's no FDA approved medication for stimulant use disorder.
Now we're going to need to take another short break, but when we return, we're going to continue this conversation about the past and present of meth with Olivia Weeks, host of the new podcast Home Cooked, and Nicole Dawsey, executive director of the nonprofit Prevent Ed. This is St. Louis on the Air.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Danny Wisentowski, in for Elaine Cha. We're looking at the history of meth in Missouri and what's changed about the drug in the last 10 or so years as other drugs have risen in prominence. I'm joined today by Olivia Weeks. She's a reporter with the Daily Yonder and the host of a new five-part podcast, Home Cooked, A 50-Year History of Meth in America, and Nicole Dawsey, executive director of the nonprofit Prevent Ed. Nicole, we actually got a call from a listener during our break who said that their nephew lived in Jefferson County. That's where you started your career in drug prevention. This nephew was addicted to meth, and when authorities began cracking down, this nephew switched to heroin because the heroin was cheap. Is that, you know, is that something that you were seeing, and do people tend to shift drugs in this way?
What's interesting about that, and first of all, I really thank the caller for calling in and shedding light on this, is that, you know, as Olivia mentioned, meth hasn't gone away, right? But what the podcast does is shed light on the fact that the various attempts to regulate and stamp down on it drives people to the black market and drives people to other drugs. Now, typically, when you have a wave of stimulants, that's usually followed by a wave of depressants, right? And then so on and so forth. So we saw methamphetamine followed by opioids. And now we're actually in the fourth wave of the opioid crisis, which is stimulants back on the scene being mixed with fentanyl. So again, to Olivia's point, it hasn't gone away. Now, typically, when somebody is looking for a stimulant, they're not necessarily going to go and look for a depressant. However, it speaks to the demand. Why are people using drugs in the first place, right? And how can we make sure that they have the support and resources they need if they want to quit? So my hunch is that there was something going on that the drug use began, right? And then when they couldn't find that drug, they found another drug that was illicit, that was on the black market, that was cheap. Because heroin at that time was very cheap.
Olivia, I want to turn this to you because, you know, during your first episode of Home Cooked, the podcast you're doing about the 50-year history of meth, you devote time to try to understand what is it like to use meth? What is it like to be addicted? What is it like for the people who go through this? Why was it important for you to include that part and to bring some voices of people who use meth a great deal?
Yeah, I think it speaks in part to this question of why you would switch from a stimulant to a depressant. One of the people who came on the podcast, his name was David Stoker. He also works in peer recovery in Springfield, Missouri now. And he was telling me that, you know, his meth use was not related to a particular drive for a stimulant, for an upper to be speeding. His use of meth was related to his trauma and the fact that he felt bad inside and this drug could make him feel good. And I think it's really baffling to try and think about why someone would be using meth and fentanyl, for instance, which is a really common trend now, if you don't understand that drug use is much more often related to a person's internal mental state than it is to a need for a specific drug. And so I was really interested in bringing on users because I think, especially if you've only ever consumed the scare tactic media, then it would just be baffling. You know, why would you ever go out of your way to use one of these drugs? And so that was the goal in bringing on those voices.
Right. And we actually have a bit of your conversation with David Stoker. He's the recovery counselor in Springfield. He talked about how he used meth for almost two decades, and he described what it feels like.
Just nonstop energy and confidence. And I mean, it's one of the best feelings I've ever had in my life. You know, I talk to people about that. Like, that's part of the problem when somebody stops using. Like, I've seen both my kids born. I've jumped out of a perfectly good airplane before. You know, I've done all kinds of things to try to chase that. And I know I will never feel that feeling again, because I'll never use again. I don't ever want to glamorize it. And sometimes it's hard to talk about it and not glamorize it. You know, I tell people, like, I love drugs. I love the way drugs make me feel, but I hate the person it turned me into over time. And that's why I don't ever want to go back. But man, I love that feeling. I love being able to go for days at a time. I love not sleeping because there's somebody who's doing something I could be doing or thinking of something I could be thinking of while I'm asleep if they're not.
And that was recovery counselor David Stoker. He spoke to our guest Olivia Weeks for the new podcast Home Cooked, a 50-year history of meth in America. Nicole, I wanted to ask what you took from David's reflection here. Does it match with what you've heard from others?
Yes. And the word I want to hone in on that he used was confidence. So we know that people use drugs to deal with a whole host of emotions. Sometimes it's boredom. Sometimes it's loneliness or isolation. Sometimes it's because you don't feel comfortable in your own skin, which is why real prevention begins in kindergarten. And you're not talking about meth or heroin or fill in the blank drug. You're talking about how to manage uncomfortable feelings, how to talk to grownups you trust about those feelings, what to do with those feelings, how to build a positive friend group. Because those are real skills, real life skills that will lead folks to be able to develop some healthy coping strategies. And I love that Olivia included people in the podcast who've used drugs because it, again, just continues to help destigmatize this notion that there are people who use drugs and then everybody else, right? We need to get past that.
Now, we began our discussion of our show with looking at this notion of Missouri as the meth capital of America and what that meant. But Olivia, at some point, Missouri stops being the meth capital of America. It stops getting that label and something does change. What happened?
Yeah. So between like 2004 and 2006, there were a slew of state and federal laws passed. The federal law was called the Combat Meth Epidemic Act, and it was actually included in the Patriot Act, weirdly. But all of these laws get passed that really regulate precursor chemicals and make it much more difficult to get your hands on the ingredients to methamphetamine. And so once home cooking is really a lot more difficult, Missouri's not special anymore. There are still meth users in Missouri, but if you're not making meth, then there's not much distinctive about the meth problem in Missouri. It's being imported from other states, and that's happening all across the country. Missouri really starts to look much more like the rest of the country. Now, that is absolutely not to say that meth goes away in almost any sense. Lots of people I spoke with in Missouri said that even throughout the peak of the prescription opioid epidemic, meth remained the major or a major problem in their counties, especially in rural places.
Is there a capital of meth in America today, or is it in America at all?
Not in America, no. There's no capital, I would say.
Maybe Mexico, because that's where it's coming from.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I wanted to ask, you know, again about, you know, the notion of Missouri as the meth capital. Nicole, this was the state in which you existed when you began this career. What is it, you know, did you agree with that label, or what does it feel like looking back at it now?
I think that I agree. I'm pausing here because I think that in a lot of ways, the label helped us get attention and federal funding to actually make a difference. The problem with the label, and this is really with the substance use field and government at large, is that once you it's like we can't focus on two things at one time, right? So now that we're the meth capital of the world, that's what we're focusing on. That's what dollars are going to. That's what efforts are going to combat. And so the heroin epidemic, the prescription drug epidemic, bit us in the butt because we didn't have our eye on the ball. Right. And so I think that and you could largely say that now all of the dollars are going towards opioids, and who knows what's the next drug out there. So sure, I think the label helped us in some ways, but it also was incredibly stigmatizing, especially to rural communities and to the people who were using meth themselves. Mm-hmm.
So your organization is, you know, it's in classrooms, it's working on drug prevention. You don't do a specific meth prevention course now, as I understand, but I guess just in general, are there lessons that we have applied, or are we making some of the same mistakes here?
I think that while we're not doing specific meth education, we are doing increasing education about overamping, which is the term used to describe an overdose from meth or cocaine. Not always fatal. Sometimes it certainly can be. I think that the state of Missouri, including Prevent Ed, is really looking at how to support people who are continuing to use meth, are continuing to use other stimulants, whether that's in conjunction with fentanyl or just being aware that fentanyl might be infiltrating their drug supply. NoMoreMeth.com is a resource that's a state resource that people can go to if they want to find out what's happening in their communities.
And Olivia, just in our final minute here, you know, what questions are you still thinking about after completing this podcast, and what lessons do you hope folks take from it?
Yeah, I think the lessons that I hope people take from it, the most important thing that I've learned reporting this podcast is that drugs are not one thing. It really, your experience of each drug depends on how you use it, how careful you are, what the drug supply looks like. And so I think thinking of meth as one thing is a mistake. And then the questions that I still have are about harm reduction and sort of the limits of harm reduction. I think it's a really important field. I think the people working in harm reduction are the people I trust the most on these issues. And also, like, how do we think more structurally about dealing with the synthetic drug crisis? I think that the individual work being done by harm reductionists is really important. But how do we think bigger? How do we get fentanyl out of the meth supply? How do we reduce the meth supply? I don't know. I don't think anybody has a good answer to that question.
Well, I've been really enjoying the podcast, and folks, I hope do get a chance to listen to it. Olivia, congratulations on completing this project, and thank you for sharing your insights with us.
Thanks again for having me.
And Nicole Dalsey is the executive director of Prevent Ed, the nonprofit helps prevent and reduce the harm of alcohol and other drug use through education, intervention, and advocacy in the St. Louis area. Nicole, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
This episode was produced by Danny Wisentowski.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
St. Louis on the Air proudly supports local artists by using music from Life Creative Group.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.